Observer.org. You're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the Texas Observer staff to take a break from writing to say things to you on the radio instead. Once again, we've got politics writer Chris Hooks in the studio. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Jonathan.
We've also got Observer Associate Editor Forrest Wilder. Hey, Forrest.
Hey, man. How you doing?
And from our Houston office, Emily DePrang joins us by phone. Thank you for being here, Emily.
My pleasure.
Later in the show, we'll be joined by freelance writer David Tice to talk about a contentious plan to restore Buffalo Bayou, which is not doing so hot thanks to erosion. But before we get to that, we have some news to discuss. Last week, we talked about the GOP convention held earlier in the month in Fort Worth. Today, we're talking about a major GOP player and asking why she has such a prominent role in the state Republican Party, given her racist views. Chris, can you tell us about Sarah Leggvold?
Sure. So Sarah Leggvold is a woman from Roanoke, Texas, who was elected at the last GOP convention in 2012 to sit on the state Republican Party's executive committee, the body of 62 people that makes decisions about the direction of the party and organizes major events like the convention. And about 6 months ago, she got in trouble on Facebook for posting messages after the death of Nelson Mandela that basically said that apartheid was the best thing to ever happen to South Africa's black population, and a variety of kind of other crazy things.
Certainly a unique view.
A very unique view. I think after Nelson Mandela died, I was surprised by how prevalent that belief is among some segments of the population. But she posted...
not nearly unique enough.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
She also posted links to Stormfront, which is a major neo-Nazi, fascist, white supremacist internet forum,
right.
And a couple of other places that you would prefer not to see a Republican official post to, American Renaissance and a couple of other kind of fringe publications. And she got in trouble for it, and it was a story for a little bit, and she issued kind of a tortured apology. The state party distanced himself from her a little bit, and then it went away, and she continued to sit on the committee.
Right.
The party said that they couldn't have forced her out necessarily, but in a lot of other states, you would imagine if someone came up like this, the party would kind of take her aside and quietly convince her to step down. So she continued to operate with the party. A while ago, I friended her on Facebook, as a millennial investigative reporter does. And
she accepted your friend request?
As a millennial investigative reporter, that's all they do.
Yes.
Is just troll social media.
Oh,
absolutely.
Stop.
Well, I'm old, you know.
She didn't even really, roll back kind of her more extreme opinions. She subscribes to anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. She really does not like black people, immigrants, holds really strong views about gay people, and subscribes to absolutely just bonkers ideas about what Muslims do and want to do in the United States. It's kind of difficult to describe.
Right. Yeah, it seems like it would be difficult to describe without sort of just like listing detail by detail. But she sounds like she'd be a lot of fun to hang out with at a party.
Yeah, I am.
At the Republican Party?
Maybe at the Republican Party, yeah.
But I guess, you know, some people were joking. It's like, well, what? Okay, so why isn't it that she doesn't fit in with the Republican Party? But, okay, haha. But I mean, really,
right.
I mean, this is extreme for any major political party. I mean, like or dislike the Tea Party, typically you don't have people, especially in an elected leadership position, espousing these kind of views. So for me, the question has been, how come this wasn't dealt with at, if they're not going to boot her off the executive committee somehow, why did she still have such a prominent place at the convention?
Right.
Why wasn't there more of an effort by, Steve Ministeri, the Texas head of the Texas Republican Party, who executive director, who has made a lot of effort, at least rhetorically, to reach out to Hispanics, to reach out to women and African-Americans, people who aren't naturally gravitating to the Republican Party right now.
And I guess that's the thing, is she didn't just serve out the rest of her term. She's stepping down after the most recent convention, but she was given one of the 30 spots on the committee that drafted the platform, the party's platform this year. She was sought to endorse major statewide candidates. Her name appeared on a lot of the kind of events on the fringes of the convention center because she had the support of the party. She was a member of the state leadership, and on one hand, you could say this is one woman in a group of people, but I think the problem is if you're a Republican and you're kind of trying to rein in some of the excesses of the party, there are a lot of people that have kind of extreme views like this, or maybe don't go quite as far as Sarah Leibold, but are kind of commonly accepted and part of the fabric of the party. And if you've spent a lot of time with people like Leibold at Tea Party groups, the people who really like had a strong influence this election cycle and the people whose candidates won, they have a lot of these kind of fringe beliefs, and there's no one telling them this doesn't belong in the party. You have to tone this down.
There's no antibodies within the body of the party. I mean, she was elected. As far as we know, nobody was sort of saying like, hey guys, time out, you know, we might really like Sarah, but do we want her representing us considering her views on everything having to do with race, religion, ethnicity, et cetera? It just didn't happen. But I guess the other question is, well, so what? It's not, she's stepping down. She's sort of a minor figure, certainly not a household name. It's kind of random. Why do we really care so much?
I think this is something that the party has to be dealing with going forward. Is there's kind of a system in place that facilitates influence by people like this, I guess.
I think the answer is that that she is an official representative of the party, and you know, just like we're saying, it says something about the internal politics that she could get so far without anybody seeming to raise an eyebrow or really even remark on it. I mean, it's sort of conspicuous in its absence, there being any outcry about this. Also interesting that she helped write this platform.
Right.
That is a sort of a fascinating document, and it's kind of a media party every 2 years, and this thing comes out. And I think this year might have topped even previous years, which is really saying something.
Right. We talked about reparative therapy on the last episode, but there are certainly some other things that have come to light since the platform was released earlier this week. What do you guys think about it?
Well, I mean, there's always the, you know, some stuff that it just kind of persists from year to year.
Sure.
So there's not necessarily a lot of news value in, for example, that the wacky Agenda 21 thing is mm-hmm. still in there. I mean, I think it's, to me, what's beautiful about the platform is that it's written by the absolute true believers, the people that are like right on the vanguard of Republican grassroots thinking. And so some of the stuff in there just would seem to most people completely random. Like, what? Who's ever heard of United Nations Agenda 21? But it is an obsession on the right, this idea that some obscure document that the United Nations put out in the early 90s is like this blueprint being used by, you know, a coalition of extreme environmentalists and socialists to socially and environmentally engineer the planet in such a way as to force collectivism on everybody and take away our freedoms. So that is just one small part of what is, I think, like, what, a 40 page when it was printed out, ran in well into the dozens of pages.
Yeah, I had a question. I saw several places where it said, and I always saw this quote as sort of freestanding, we support a woman's right to choose to dedicate her life to her family and home. I don't know what that means.
No, I mean, it's beautiful, right? They believe in a woman's right to choose to stay home and take care of the house. What don't you understand?
Right, but what
about
is that politically? What does that mean? I mean, is there like are there a lot of bills that are threatening to force labor on women? There are, using labor in another term, but like, are there? What does that mean? Like,
you're asking a serious question.
That I don't get, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's reading the platform. One of the strange things about it is a lot of them seem like it's rebutting a point which is not in the platform and is maybe not even something that most people are aware of.
It's like kind of insidery. The whole document's kind of not. It seems like the platform is supposed to be this statement to the outside of what the Republican Party stands for, but it feels like something that, six or seven people wrote in their clubhouse, like to post on the wall of their clubhouse. Maybe that's really what it is. Maybe it's not a declaration to guide the larger party or to tell Republicans what they stand for collectively. Maybe it's kind of an inside joke.
Well, I mean, I think you're right insofar as it is written by members of a clubhouse. Probably not. It's not six or seven, of course. But yeah, I mean, essentially, I mean, the weird thing about the platform, this goes for the Democratic Party platform, too, is that on one hand, it's completely meaningless. It's not binding. The elected officials don't really pay much attention to it. It's a joke. On the other hand, because it is taken so seriously and because it is the sort of like textual representation of the beliefs of the Republican or the Democratic Party, it matters at that level. You know, so this year we saw a huge fight over primarily the immigration plank. Mm-hmm. In 2012, a group of folks within the party, you know, Jerry Patterson, the land commissioner of Texas, who recently ran for lieutenant governor, was one of the most visible faces of the successful effort to toss out some of the more anti-immigrant sort of xenophobic language and replace it with something called the Texas Solution, which sounds sort of ominous, but really all it was a very vaguely defined guest worker program. And frankly, it got an enormous amount of praise from people in the media and mainstream figures of business community because it seemed to represent kind of a turn in the Republican Party of Texas towards a more sensible stance on immigration. But this year, we went back in the other direction, and that ended up being a floor fight, a fight that, Chris, I think you saw quite a bit of.
Yeah, this is Sarah Leggevold was actually involved in drafting language that undid much of the Texas Solution, and while her amendment didn't come through, a similar amendment did, replaced a lot of the language, minimized discussion of the guest worker program, which was kind of their one offering from 2012, and put a lot of other hardline language in. And yeah, I guess the party, some people in the party would like to say that the words of these people don't really matter. And you actually had Steve Ministeri come out today and kind of walk back the reparative therapy plank for homosexuality, and
the cure the gays thing is the shorthand for it, I think.
So yeah,
people understand what it is.
He walked that back a little bit, but in a way, like having this this kind of like clear demonstration of the base's id or whatever you want to call it is important because these are the people that are increasingly making the decisions in the Republican Party, and the slate of candidates coming up this year are from these people in a way that they weren't before.
Right, almost just like a Connie Burton, who is running for Senate District 10, the seat that Wendy Davis is vacating and leans Republican, so she's likely to be in the Texas Senate. I mean, she is of this cast of characters. And so the platform has been kooky for a long time, but I mean, it's a really good point that now actually it kind of is more and more representing the views of the mainstream of the party and elected officials. So the folks who are actually writing the laws believe this stuff. And as you know, perhaps this is a blueprint for some of the legislation that we are and will see going forward, or at least a list of principles and priorities.
And as part of that, this week we saw this renewed focus on immigration and border control that we has been the focus of Dan Patrick's campaign and some other people's campaign and was a big focus of the convention. But now we have kind of Dan Patrick who's ascendant and is preparing to take power in the Texas Senate and is using his influence to push some of these measures that other legislators have been pushing for this week. We had the Speaker of the House, Joe Strauss, and Dan Patrick and Rick Perry get together with what they're calling a surge along the border,
right?
Taking some kind of martial language from Afghanistan or Iraq. That a plan that they're going to deploy DPS down to the border to stop this kind of increased numbers of immigrants from Central America.
But is that the idea? I mean, okay, there's this humanitarian crisis of children crossing the border you know, on their own or maybe with their mother, just an enormous influx that is at least partially driven by what's happening in Central America and perhaps also by immigration policies in the U.S. But is this border security plan that Texas is talking about, sending DPS agents to address that directly, or is it just a more generalized kind of, oh, God, the border's porous, let's go run down there and do something? We have details on this.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can say that it's a game being played. It's election season, and it's people in the Republican Party who are kind of posturing to get leverage over each other. So a big part of the discussion that was had was over whether Joe Strauss, the Speaker of the House, who a lot of Republicans don't like, would sign it. He finally got on board with it.
Yeah.
And from what the DPS is saying, we know that they will not be using these resources to handle or take on the problem of these immigrants that are coming over the border. By law, they're only using that resources to tackle human trafficking and drug traffickers. So it's happening in a vacuum. It has nothing to do with what's happening in the real world on the border. From Dan Patrick's statements on the program, we know that it's going to be his first focus when he gets to the Texas Senate. And that's something that a lot of people,
if he does, he has an election in November. Let's not forget.
That's right. True.
He's probably the favorite. He's definitely the favorite, but he still hasn't a real opponent.
That's true. Yeah.
And it's interesting because, Dewhurst kept talking about the surge when he was on the campaign trail. And then it just went quiet there for a while. And this was before the kids crossing the border became such a precipitous event. So it went quiet and it sort of went underground. I think part of the problem was that Joe Strauss had expressed some concerns or opposition to the terms of it. But it all of a sudden it's come roaring back with a vengeance. From the sounds of it, it's an open-ended operation. It's definitely through the end of the year. And I thought there was some interesting language in the press release today talking about how they were going to deal with the problem of illegal entry. Illegal entry is actually it's a federal crime.
Right.
And it's one of the most prosecuted federal crimes in the country right now. But it is a federal crime. It's prosecuted by federal prosecutors, and the affidavits that are used to basically convict people illegally crossing the border are produced by Border Patrol agents who are trained to do this. So you get into this weird space where is Texas really equipped to launch some sort of like seal the border operation? And that is the rhetoric that the Dan Patricks of the world are using. We are going to seal the border, and you know, subtext or subpoint, we don't care how much it costs, right? This is such a priority, but is it the feasibility of it, the desirability of it? That's a whole sort of separate question.
There's this kind of categorical confusion about the problems that are being addressed by this action. So, like Dan Patrick will talk a lot about human trafficking, and human trafficking is terrible. I mean, it's a moral crime. It's a real problem on the border. But efforts to make it harder to get across the border make human trafficking more profitable and more prevalent. And there's a kind of a confusion about what needs to be done. And I think it'll be interesting to see if Dan Patrick does make it to the Senate. People have been kind of in the business community and in a lot of other parts of the state have been worried about the kind of measures that he would pass if he had real power in the legislature in terms of getting rid of sanctuary cities.
What does getting rid of sanctuary cities mean? Because that's...
Well, this has come up before, and it was a big problem because Perry tried to make it a priority and never could adequately address the question of what a sanctuary city is. The reason being there's no such thing. It's just a term that it's a conjuring word or conjuring phrase that's used to basically, to scare people. The closest anybody can come to saying what a sanctuary city is where police departments or other law enforcement agencies have a policy of not asking about citizenship status when they're trying to solve crimes. That's the case here in Austin. And the reason for that is because it makes it harder to get people to talk, which you need to in order to solve crimes. So other than that, it's pretty hard to say what a sanctuary city is. Municipalities typically don't get very involved in immigration stuff.
So we get to find out what that is whenever legislation banning sanctuary cities shows up.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how you write a bill.
Right now, it's in the platform, right?
I believe it is. I don't think it explains it, but it's like a lot of the phrases in the platform. They're just you. If you don't know what it means, then
it's a dog whistle.
Maybe you should have read the first three books in the series. Then you'd know.
Right.
Well, Chris.
I just want to know who dies.
Everyone dies. Chris, Emily, and Forrest, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks
for having me.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. If you live in Houston, you may want to pay extra close attention to this next bit. Buffalo Bayou has seen better days, and evidence of that is visible in the form of erosion. There is a plan to restore and stabilize the bayou. Proponents say it's a necessary measure. Some opponents say it's only going to benefit River Oaks Country Club's golf course. Here to talk to us about the plan and what it may mean for Buffalo Bayou is freelance writer and native Houstonian David Tice. Mr. Tice, thanks for being on the show.
Glad to be here.
If you wouldn't mind, could you give us a quick summary of your story from The Observer?
Okay. Like you said, Buffalo Bayou, there is a fair amount of erosion in the bayou. When you get downstream from it, when there's a big rain or something, you'll see a lot of silt along walkways and that kind of thing. And property owners along Buffalo Bayou, including the River Oaks Country Club, are having to take measures to shore up their banks. And so there has been talk about doing something about the erosion. An expert on river hydrology was brought in a few years ago to come in and sort of make recommendations.
Right.
Those recommendations, the Harris County Flood Control District took those recommendations, I don't think he actually made specific recommendations about Buffalo Bayou, but the sort of general principles he works from.
Okay.
They apparently took them and came up with a plan to deal with erosion.
Well, let's talk about that plan very, very quickly, just because it sounds pretty invasive. I mean, what you describe in your piece is almost like kind of clear cutting the area around the bayou.
That's the point, is that the plan, it does appear, would be very invasive. The first thing you should know about Buffalo Bayou is that even though it runs through downtown, but in stretches that are actually pretty close to downtown, it is still in a fairly wild state. I mean, it's sort of unusual for a city the size of Houston to have something that is fairly close to actually being wilderness, you know, just sort of right there.
Right.
And you know, we're a bit starved for scenery here. And so a lot of people feel pretty protective of Buffalo Bayou because it actually is sort of an amazing landscape,
right,
and riverscape. And it's probably the forest that surrounds the woods, it's called a riparian forest that surrounds the bayou, is probably pretty similar to the landscape, you know, that the Allen Brothers found when they established Houston. And there's really nothing much else really like that very close to the center of town at all. What the Harris County Flood Control District is proposing to do would really sort of change that landscape. And so there's been, among environmental groups and people who just love Buffalo Bayou, there's a pretty strong pushback.
What are they claiming is the problem with this?
Well, the plan calls for, it's a test program. And in this area, it's really sort of particularly beautiful. It's in the Hogg Bird Center, right across from where the mansion where Ima Hogg used to live. There's some very steep cliffs. That's near where the country club is as well. But in that particular area, about almost 6,000 feet of the banks of that area, they're going to take these cliffs and sort of drastically change them so they're not really cliffs anymore. They'll be sort of a gentle slope. They'll have to sort of scrape the area to do this. Many, many trees will come out to be replaced with Bermuda grass. There's lots of wildlife in the area, birds and other animals, all kinds of animals that will lose their habitat if this happens.
Which I find particularly strange because I believed after reading your piece that part of the point in putting this plan into action was to recreate those habitats that are currently not really serviceable to the creatures that live there.
They say that in a period of time that the habitat will come back and, you know, folks be better than ever. But, you know, that to a lot of people, That seems like, well, you know, A, you know, if it comes back in 10 years, the habitat that lives, you know, the animals that live there now, the wildlife that lives there now, can't wait for 10 years.
Right.
And who knows what will happen, you know. And so, but also this kind of beautiful landscape of, you know, the cliffs and the exposed rocks, which, you know, if you live in Austin, exposed rocks may not seem like a big deal, but there's not many exposed rocks in Houston, but you see a few of those. And,
right.
You know,
concrete definitely doesn't
bayou.
Count. Right.
It's just, it would take something that's really unique to for this area and sort of standardize it. And Houston has a history of denaturing its bayous. This plan wouldn't be as bad as the plans that got enacted back in the 60s where they could take bayous and literally line them with concrete.
Right.
But it seems bad enough, though. And it would really change it from a pretty wild space into something that was no longer really could be described as such.
I was wondering if there had been any updates to this story since you wrote it.
This is sort of a waiting period. The Army Corps of Engineers has to approve the Harris County Flood Control District's application to do this work. They're waiting until June 30th. People have until June 30th to enter comments, to make comments about either pro or con, this plan. And so until that happens, there probably won't be any, serious updates. There's been some sort of background. There's some groups opposed to the plan have dug up some information, like, for example, that they put out, for example, that the river hydrologist, whose name is escaping me right now, Dave Rosgen, I think, that's not really clear that he actually, even though he came to look at the bayou a few years ago, it's not clear that he actually approves of this particular plan.
Right.
That there's some video footage of him saying that he kind of liked the bayou the way it is. So there's that. But I can't say there's any sort of major development, so.
Well, Mr. Tice, thank you so much for being on the show.
Sure.
We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music, and of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin. Our sound engineer for this episode is Leah Manners. Our apprentice is Michael Brown. For more Texas news and culture, visit us on the web at texasobserver.org or pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk to you again next time on Observer Radio.